This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language. The XX Gabfest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, March 21st, the Office Wife edition. I'm Hannah Rosen here in the DC studio. I am joined in New York by New Republic writer Noreen Malone. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah.
And Slate contributor Seth Stevenson. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Hannah.
Our three topics today are, one, the retro housewife. Do we all secretly want to revive her? Two, the Steubenville, Ohio rape case. And three, the office wife. What makes for a perfect one? So let's start with retro housewives. New York Magazine has a cover story on the feminist stay-at-home wife, an urban hipster who decides that life is more peaceful if one person stays at home. And because women, she says, feel the tug of home more than men do, that person should be the wife. This comes on the heels of a new national study telling us that we should all marry young, as well as other signs of nostalgia out there. The New York Magazine story by Lisa Miller is about a woman named Kelly McKino, who calls herself a flaming liberal. I didn't realize anyone actually uses that phrase anymore, a flaming liberal, and a feminist, but concludes after sizing up her meager salary at her social work job that having it all means staying at home. And here is a quote from her. I want my daughter to be able to do anything she wants, but I also want to say, have a career that you can walk away from at the drop of a hat. I have to say that part of the story really killed me. Seth, do you find it convincing, as the unmarried man on our podcast, do you secretly, without telling any of your dates, yearn for a stay-at-home wife?
In the sense that I think everyone wants someone who will wash all the dishes and clean up the house and take care of the children and leave you free to do lots of stuff, sure. But no, not totally, in the sense that I find it attractive in women when they like their jobs and they're good at their jobs and they're ambitious and they have passions. So I sort of have mixed feelings about it, I guess.
Okay, just do the hypothetical. Like, let's say you have a wife or you have a girlfriend, and then she tells you that she wants to stay at home. Do you then feel like, what is the innermost feeling you have? Like, do you first delight and then you worry, or do you first worry and then delight?
This is so hypothetical, Hannah, because I live by myself with no wife or children anywhere in sight. But I'm trying to imagine myself in this situation. I mean, I imagine first you would think about finances, right? Can we afford to have only one person working? That's going to come into play. I mean, mainly if it's what she wants to do and that excites her and she's passionate about being a mom and staying home and doing it, then I would support that. I guess I would worry a little bit that she would get bored or that she would be boring, maybe. But
that's exactly the answer I gave when people asked me what would happen if my husband. The reason I put you on the spot like that is because during my book tour, so many people put me on the spot like that. And they were like, OK, your husband comes home and he says he's going to be a stay at home dad. Like, are you attracted to him? Do you worry about it? So I just wanted to do that back to somebody. Sorry. So I chose you. Well, first of all, I have many problems with this story. One is that it's not really a trend, right? We've hashed this out over the opt-out revolution. Like, there's a little bit of an opt-out revolution, slightly more than you'd expect, but it's not really a phenomenon. Most people can't afford to stay home. And, you know, it's sort of people at the very top of the economic spectrum and at the very bottom who stay at home, but it's not a reality for most middle-class Americans. And the second thing is this assumption that it has to be the woman. Like, to me, it can be like, you could pay the help. It could be the man. Like, that's the part that I take issue with.
The part I took issue with was actually the same thing that bugged me about the feminine mystique, weirdly enough. It's this either or. I feel like this magazine story was very much coming from itself a really retro place where stay-at-home moms and working moms are in opposition to each other. Like, it felt almost 80s to me, like, right? Like, you had to be either a militant working mom or you were this, like, super old-fashioned person. And it was... they were surprising us by telling us that, you know, modern women could want something off other than the boardroom, right? And that felt like a weirdly old-fashioned notion. It sort of didn't understand the point of choice feminism, you know, which is not all or nothing in either direction.
Right. Like, we've talked about the Beyoncé Mrs. Carter tour, right? Like, the point is that you can sample, right? Like, you can do a little bit of this, you can do a little bit of that. You don't have to absolutely choose one path or absolutely choose another.
Hannah, have you heard Beyoncé's new song?
I can't deal with Beyoncé after that documentary. I wish I'd never seen it. I don't like her anymore. I have to just say that.
Her new song is Bow Down, Bitches, and there's a line, and I wish I could remember the exact line, but she's basically like, I'm not just my husband's wife, in effect. Like, you guys think that's what's happening, but, like, that's not what's happening. And it's wonderfully timed to the opening of the Mrs. Carter tour.
Wait, is this an imperative to her female listeners as telling them to bow?
Wait, I think it's like critics. It's critics and like people who are like coming at her. I mean, it's a great command, like bow down, bitches.
Omnidirectional, like, bitches.
Yeah. I'm one of those bitches because I'm not bowing down anymore. I'm all on Rihanna's team now.
We should go out on that music.
We should.
I found this story a little bit silly. To me, this was sort of a shark jumpy moment for these big magazine cover stories about the mommy wars. What did this add to the conversation? It felt like we were just circling around and rehashing the same thing we've been talking about before, and this didn't really bring anything new. This is about one woman who had lots of options and decided what she liked in life was to stay home and be a really devoted mom. Good for her. Why do we need to talk about this?
That's actually a funny notion, Seth, that everybody's, they're like, well, if the Atlantic can do it, like, maybe we can just run a big one too and, you know, dominate the national conversation for the ladies, you know?
I sort of think that's probably what was thought in that meeting. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there, obviously, but it read like that. It was like, okay, people are talking about Marissa Mayer and Sheryl Sandberg. We got to say something about the ladies.
Right. So what about the general nostalgia? That's the one thing I took away from this. Why doesn't that die? This idea that, you know, we are nostalgic for a time that we can't have. I mean, we've talked about this on this podcast many times around Martha Stewart and the feminine mystique and, you know, the young hipsters kind of darning and quilting, like this sort of American notion we have. It's almost like first we dreamed about living on farms. Now we dream about being the housewife and we can't let it go in these retro forms.
I think it has something to do with our unhealthy relationship to work and the way that work has, for many people, subsumed a lot of their hobbies and free time. So you're working, let's say, 12 hours a day, but that doesn't mean you still don't want a nice life where your house is clean and you have nice laundry and you yourself, you know, do something fun like cooking or playing with your kids. I mean, those are fun things. And just because you're, you know, concentrating your energy in a different place in your life doesn't mean you don't want them. And so then that turns into nostalgia, right? Like, that's what it looks like when you express that fantasy, is it looks like nostalgia.
So the tug is not really a tug to be like Kelly McKino, but it's a tug to have some kind of emotional connection with our home and our children that doesn't feel like it's, you know, taking us away from work or unnatural or something we have to be self-conscious about or think about too much. It's like, why can't we just be relaxed at home and sort of think about home things and not feel guilty?
So this is like an ancient human instinct. Like, nesting is a real thing. Like, humans love their families and their homes, and that's not changing because women and men are working more.
To me, the controversial questions in the story were, A, are women more suited to do this than men, which Kelly McKino feels, and which Anne-Marie Slaughter sort of suggested a little bit in her piece. And then the second one is, are children better off if there's someone staying home with them all the time, baking cookies and doing DIY projects and so forth? To me, those are the two interesting questions here.
So let's take the first of Seth's questions, the gender essentialism, that even though I know at some level for it to be true, I fight against it with every fiber of my being. It's like the most feminist part of me, I think, that fights that notion. Like, I'm always trying to redefine it. This is a moment where we're discussing housework and that being the last feminist frontier. Jess Gross wrote a story actually called The Final Feminist Frontier, Cleaning in the New Republic. And this idea that there are things that men do and there are things that women do. And I don't really like to define the things that women do as the essential domestic things. Like, I don't want to undefine like mowing the lawn or changing the light bulbs or whatever it is men do with kids. I want to redefine those as just as essential as the things that women do. But I'm fighting a losing battle here.
I don't think so. I think the tide is turning with you.
I would not want to completely leave the world of work. You know, there are parts of my job that really challenge me and make me really happy. There are lots of parts of my jobs that I could do without. But I could see shifting the balance and spending a lot of time with my kids and trying to only take on those things that are really exciting and challenging to me and trying to fit them into a more domestic-oriented life. I think I could do that.
Yeah, somebody at the Times wrote, now I can't remember who, although
it was Michael Weinrich.
Yeah, it was Michael Weinrich.
That was a good piece. And he talked about sort of sacrificing, not grabbing for the breast ring, and sort of sacrificing some of his ambition in order to stay home and spend more time with his kids. And he seemed to think that was, he'd made a really smart trade-off.
Right. Okay, well, good. You're a good man, Seth. All that says is you're a good man. I suspect that we're all slightly wrong. And of course, women, you know, slightly want to do this more than men. And that's where the world is going to end up. But I'm just going to fight it until we have all the proof that it can't happen. There was a second question you brought up to wind down
the children better off having a parent be at the man or woman fully devoted to their care and feeding and happiness?
That seems like something we could devote an entire like season of podcasts to debating, right?
Yes and no is the answer to that question. I mean, I'm going to take the lead here as the person with my 12 years of child rearing experience. You know, a situation in which both parents are working all the time is a little bit sad, right? Like, that's just sad. Like, if everyone comes home at 8 o'clock every night, you never eat dinner together. That's not that great, you know? On the other hand, I have seen bad and good parents of every type. I swear on my life, I'm not just defending my nice working life. I definitely have. I've seen really toxic, you know, stay-at-home situations and really toxic mom work situations. It doesn't seem to me to be the critical factor in determining whether you have a happy domestic home life. Like, balance seems to be a critical factor, like how intrusive a parent is, sort of how excited and passionate. I mean, I know stay-at-home moms who, like, they are destined to be stay-at-home moms. That's what they should be. It's mellow, their home life. Like, I want to live in their house and be their child. I know we fight about it all the time, but it's not the crucial dividing line. The crucial dividing line are other things, but not whether you stay at home or work. That's just one of the questions that you ask about whether you have a happy childhood or not.
I love that answer, and I wish that New York Magazine had written that and not this battle line drawing one that will sell copies of the newsstand.
Did either of your mothers work?
Both my parents worked. My mom would drop me off at daycare and then go to work. And when I was old enough, I was a latchkey kid who would come home and be alone in the house, you know, for whatever it was, 3 or 4 hours every afternoon. I think I turned out fine. I feel pretty well adjusted. At the same time, I have friends where one parent stays home all the time. And when I go to their houses, like you were saying, Hannah, it is adorable. They're cooking things with the kids. And these kids seem so happy and so well cared for. But I also have two friends who are both very high-powered tech executives, and they have a full-time nanny who stays at home with the kids and devotes all this time to doing craft projects with them. And those kids are also happy. There are many ways to handle this situation.
I was at South by Southwest for a story, and I went to a keynote given by Elon Musk, who is this, you know, very famous, very wealthy tech entrepreneur, and he has five kids, and he started talking about his work-life balance. Like, the interviewer asked him about it, and he was like, oh, well, I like answer email while I'm talking to my kids, but, you know, spending time with them is really important. And the guy was like, how do you do it? And he goes, a nanny. And just like a woman, like, I'm sure Marissa Meyer would not have answered it that way. She never would have been like, yeah, I have a nanny there all the time, even when I'm like hanging out with him and answering email. But I mean, it was just sort of an honest answer that he could give.
Maybe kids are better off not with one parent staying home, but with a devoted professional whose entire life is centered on making children happy. And that's their job and their passion in life. And you pay them to do it. Maybe that's the message.
I've had the same nanny for 12 years, and she has a lovely relationship with it's very different than my relationship. And they get very different things out of her than they do out of me. But I, you know, no sweat on that one. That's what she's paid for. So unlike me, who when I'm home with them is also like making dinner and also doing this and also, you know, whatever. It's great to have that kind of relationship. It's like a grandparent around all the time. I have nothing bad to say about it. Okay, let's move on to our second topic, which is the Steubenville rape case. But before we do, we want to welcome back our loyal sponsor, Audible.com. Audible offers over 100,000 audiobooks, as well as any form of enlightened chatter available on the internet. And you can listen to them on any device, including the one you're using to listen to us right now. For Double X listeners who are not already Audible members, they offer a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at our special URL, audiblepodcast.com/XX, not Double X, but XX. The book I'm going to recommend this week is Marilyn Robinson's Housekeeping, which is, you know, one of my top five favorite books. But also, if you want to indulge your retro wife instincts, and then if you want to have those crushed in the most beautiful elegiac way, you should read or listen to Housekeeping, which is an amazing book on that subject. Okay, let's move on to the terrible Steubenville rape case. Two high school football stars in a football-crazy town, their names are Trent Mayes and Malik Richmond, were convicted this week of raping a 16-year-old girl from across the river at a party. Because the victim was unconscious, the evidence largely consisted of cell phone pictures and text messages sent around the school, which show her being dragged by her ankles and wrists, naked and half-naked. It has kids tweeting things like, "The song of the night is Rape Me by Nirvana." And also, "Some people deserve to be peed on." Those are some of the gems that came out in the Twitter feeds, which effectively created a graphic public diary of her assault. So here's the thing I'm thinking about in this case. This is obviously a crime in the age of social media. The question I was discussing actually with my husband last night, which Noreen, you can answer today on the podcast, is the social media aspect of this case is very strange because, on the one hand, social media provided all of the evidence in the case that allowed her to have her retribution. It was like a living diary of what had happened that night, which is otherwise very difficult to get. On the other hand, you can imagine a case in which, if there had been no social media, basically, her experience would have left her feeling shamed and horrible, but would have been buried. Like, her parents never would have known about it. There wouldn't have been as much of a lasting impact as there have been. In a way, it's the social media that was the crime against her. And so I had a hard time sort of coming to terms with what the role of social media was and whether it was good or bad in this case. And I mean, these are the cases we're going to face in the future. But what did you make of the social media part of it?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because it's at once both completely new territory and then it's this ancient human instinct. Like, I kept picturing like the Scarlet Letter. It turns out that actually just this week, I believe, after these two boys were convicted, two girls who went to the same high school were then arrested for threatening the victim over social media. So this is continuing spiraling. There are accusations still being thrown around on Twitter and Facebook. But yeah, it's this old instinct, first of all, to shame someone publicly, which is what was going on with the boys who posted the, you know, the YouTube videos of the rape occurring.
You mean they were shaming her publicly?
They were shaming her publicly.
Did you watch that Deadspin video? Did any of you? It's like a really long 12-minute video. And they are just, the boys are going on and on. And it's like David, my husband, said, you know, like, I remember not doing that, but like, I remember being a high school boy where you're just like, you're all kind of drunk. You're all at a party. This is not one of the guys who was convicted. This is their friend who showed up a lot in the trial. He's talking smack and talking and talking and talking for like 15 minutes, you know, like metaphors. They raped her like Mike Tyson. You know, he's just going on on, having such a good time with it. And it's crazy. Like, no one stops it. No one puts an end to it. And yet it's just like recognizable boy shit, you know?
But it's ending up on Deadspin, which, you know, millions of people read every day.
Right.
So that's one of the other aspects of this, is that it's been amplified by the involvement, I think, largely of Anonymous, the hacktivist group. The New York Times reported on this story maybe back in December, and that's when it first began to be noticed by the national media. But Anonymous really took up the cause and really pursued this kind of vigilante justice, not just about the boys' conviction, but about the Steubenville High School football coach, whom they said was not being held accountable, who had known about the rape but had not, you know, kicked the players off the team and that kind of thing. And that seems also new, that the vigilantism would not be sort of contained in a discrete geographical area.
Yeah, but if the crime against her is the constant spread of this information, which seems to me what happened, right? She does not go to their school. She lives across the river from them. She's an honor student who goes to a religious school, right? She went to a party and got drunk, which any of us could have done, and then was unconscious and all this crap happened to her. I mean, the fact that it's like Deadspin and Anonymous and that the case is going on and on, and like, are we not compounding the crime against her?
Completely. And, you know, I would love a lawyer to talk about what the implications are in terms of the criminal justice system. You know, what is libel here? You know, what is slander? What is admissible evidence? And not all of the YouTube videos, I believe, were admissible in the case.
I mean, by the terms of Emily Bazelon's book, Sticks and Stones, this is just a nightmare at every level, right? She writes about how quickly these things spread once they start, how little self-control teenagers have at that age, that you have a perfect storm of kind of easily transferable media meets the lack of self-control, basically, and self-discipline that teenagers have at that age, you know, meets a kind of law enforcement community that has a huge amount of pressure on it to do something quickly. Although in this case, I don't think the punishments are too harsh for what happens. I mean, the definition of rape has expanded. This counts as rape under the Ohio law. And so the football players and the media keep saying their lives are ruined. But in fact, it seems to me a just punishment for what happened. Before I move on to sort of how the media has treated her and the anonymity, I just want to get your sense of, like, you know, the boy raucousness. Like, could you put yourself in that situation? Of course, you would say, like, I would have told him to shut up, or I would have helped the girl or whatever. But what feelings do you have when you imagine yourself, you know, hanging out with these dudes for hours?
I remember being at parties in high school where, you know, one girl would get super, super drunk and her eyes would be at half mast, and she obviously didn't really know what was going on and was really vulnerable. And none of my friends would have done anything like this or encouraged anything like this. But I feel like when that situation would start to happen, when the girl would start to become clearly too drunk, there was always this gaggle of slightly less drunk girls who would surround her and protect her. Where were this girl's friends? Where were the other girls who were looking out for her, putting an end to this when she was being violated like this? Were there just no other girls around? That was confusing to me. The other thing I was thinking about with the guys who did it, you know, I think it's part sexual urge on their part, but it's also part sort of just prank. Like, they've got this drunk girl, and if it had been a drunk guy, they would have drawn things on his face. They would have, you know, done other things to humiliate him.
Which is not as bad.
Obviously, like, not.
No, but, I take your comparison.
It's like it's prank mixed with sexual urge that makes it this terrible, humiliating thing.
They were clearly much more high off the prank, because there was no evidence of semen on her. And the most, when they reconstructed that evening, you know, it was like he digitally penetrated her and then somebody was kind of naked next to her. But nobody raped her in the traditional sense of rape. They raped her in the expanded definition sense of rape. And then I think the worst part of it was the kind of constant unending humiliation, which is all social media.
And that's what's interesting to me about the boys' instincts, is their instinct to publicize it. And I wonder if it was somehow a way of making themselves feel better about it. Like, here's a funny thing we did. Like, look at it. Instead of it being this, like, dark, shameful, terrible thing that they had done, which it actually was. But there was something about, like, turning it into a YouTube video that made it more of a prank, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's a kind of rape, like the rape that happens in war, right? I mean, there's one kind of rape where, like, a predator tracks down a woman alone and rapes her. And then there's a whole other category of rape, which has to do with kind of male social bonding, right? What happens when, you know, crews of men in different countries, like, go gang rape women during war. Like, that's a different kind of rape instinct. And that's the one that seemed to be operating here. I mean, if you read, we'll post an excellent New York Times story, which was the best summary I saw of the atmosphere in the town. But, you know, it's a fairly depressed kind of former industrial town. And football is like a huge, huge big deal in the town. And these guys are gods and they get away with a lot. And, you know, that's the obvious narrative and the narrative that we want to be true. But it seems to be true in this town that, you know, they sort of operate on different rules than most people in the town. And they're like a gang and they're worshipped, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was what was going on. Like, they were having a good time. They were so much more into like the dude sitting around talking about the thing that happened than the thing that happened.
This was actually really similar to a Friday Night Lights plot. Do you guys remember that episode?
Oh, you're right. And it showed up on a YouTube video.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
You're totally right. You're
exactly
totally right. Yeah.
That's a network TV version of this. But, you know, same sort of culture that they're depicting there.
Right.
Which, you know, I think is not entirely always specific to football obsessed factory towns. It could be a lacrosse obsessed Tony suburb of D.C., you know.
It's just, or Duke. It's, right.
Right. Exactly.
One of the things that was discussed yesterday, I believe, or maybe the day before Fox News released the girl's name, people were complaining about sympathy in the media for the football players. Like, the running line seemed to be their lives were ruined. Their lives were ruined. Were you guys outraged by, you know, Fox or Candy Crowley or anybody else who mentioned her name?
I think it is fair to have a little bit of sympathy for 16 and 17 year old boys who were very, very drunk and did something horrible, but, you know, they are very young and were very drunk. And I think it's okay to have a little bit of sympathy for what's happened to them. But that said, you have to balance that out against what happened to the girl. And I feel like what people are angry about with the CNN thing is that the balance wasn't quite right.
You mean they were too much sympathy for the boys?
Too much sympathy for the boys without balancing it out against what had happened to the girl.
You know, whenever we discuss the question of anonymity of a rape victim, I am always thinking about Joan Didion's 1991 essay, Sentimental Journeys, about the Central Park jogger, in which she talks a lot about what happened when we kept that woman's name a secret. And I felt a little bit like that with this case, that when you keep the victim's name a secret, what happens is a kind of narrative develops that she has no control over and that might not have that much relationship to the truth. So I feel like, in this case, the keeping the victim's name secret and the excessive sympathy for the boys are related to each other. Like, she was just a blank space, right? We didn't know anything about her.
Her name isn't secret.
Now it's not secret.
I've never read that essay, and I'm going to get off this podcast and go read it immediately. But I think it's different when the person is a teenager. I think something that happens in the middle of New York City is very different than something that happens in Steubenville, Ohio. Like, this girl is receiving threats from her classmates, you know. I hope she is able to, like, pick up and move across the country, because that's going to be, like, a tough place for her to live. You know, I'm sure everyone in that town knows exactly who she is. Everyone has an opinion on this case. That's awful. Like, she's a 16-year-old girl. She's not going to control, or she's older now, but, like, I think controlling the narrative is a hard thing to ask of someone who's been a rape victim.
I guess that's true. So what you would do is you would let it ride out. In other words, you would insist on keeping her name secret and then just let the story ride out. Like, let that little bit of sympathy that, Seth, you were saying is appropriate seep out for these 16 and 17-year-old boys, and then just let them serve their sentence and let the case disappear, because she's already so vulnerable. Like, she's already getting threats from everywhere.
Unfortunately, my sense is that maybe a similar things happen every other weekend somewhere in the United States. And this one happened to blow up because there was a lot of social media evidence.
Maybe the answer is that people will stop producing the social media evidence.
I don't think that's true.
Maybe this is like what Emily Bazelon says, like, maybe that's what becomes true over a period of time, is in the same way that people, young people, are slightly more careful about what they put on their Facebook pages now because they know that they're going to be looking for a job someday. People will learn to brag without their cell phone cameras on.
But let's go back to the original counterfactual we started with, which is, like, let's say no one had uploaded anything to YouTube. Would she have been able to report this? Would she have been taken seriously? Would someone have been able to make it go away quietly? You know, is that better? I genuinely don't know.
I don't know the answer to that either. I mean, there, you know, Emily Bazelon wrote a great story in the New York Times Magazine about the girls who had been child porn victims and who were using the law to get retribution from the people who were viewing the pictures, not the people just who had made the pictures. And I think that sort of budding area of the law is trying to quantify the harm that you face by having something that's happened to you that's sexual be out there in the world and be viewed by a lot of people. That's like a new area of law where you can actually say that in and of itself, apart from the original crime, is harmful and does do damage, and you are entitled to retribution about that. And I think that's why, you know, it's slightly insane that they arrested the girls who threatened her by text, but I think that's where we're going, is like trying to sort of put some weight on that, so that those girls are also responsible for something.
Oh, the whole thing is just so sad and awful.
It is so sad and awful. And it's like, oh, you just got to see those pictures of those dudes like hugging each other. And, you know, one of the guys actually, you know, walked up to the family and said, like, I can't believe I did this. I never meant to do this. I mean, again, it's just like you realize they're 16. You know, they did a super awful thing. Now they're in a completely different place. Now they're going to jail. I mean, it's just such a mess. You realize, like, putting social media in the hands of 16 and 17-year-olds who are going to be prone to behave this way anyway and drink, it's like it's just a disaster. And we'll have case after case of this until what? I don't know. Until what, like, teenagers learn to be more – I don't even know what the answer is, you know?
Until human nature radically changes and evolves.
Exactly. Till we give teenagers an anti-teenager pill. Okay. Well, let's move on to our third topic, which is very, very, very different, which is the work wife. Seth Stevenson wrote a delightful piece in GQ this month about the treasure that is the perfect office wife and how to go about finding one. I read this piece and I was extremely nostalgic because now I mostly work at home, but I did once have a really, really excellent work marriage, and it was really a perfect relationship, exactly as Seth describes it. And an example of what David Owen, who long ago in The Atlantic, once described as the perfect platonic intimacy. Seth, can I read a paragraph from your piece? Is that going to embarrass you? Can I do that?
Oh, please. Go ahead. Propagate my work.
I shall propagate your work. Okay. Seth writes about his office wife. Ours was a beautiful work marriage built on mutual affection and understanding. I let her prattle on about her idyllic life with her actual husband, cooed over photos of three-bedroom condos she hoped to buy, and gave her a big happy hug when she announced that she'd become pregnant. She let me prattle on about my disastrous romantic misadventures, helped me draft polite but firm text messages, declining second dates, and repeatedly assured me that I would not die alone at 53. Via aspiration of unheated minestrone soup chucked straight from the can. I thought 53 was a little young. I mean, you're pretty fit and everything. Why 53? Like, why not 73?
The trend is not good, Hannah. I keep going the way I'm going.
Can you talk a little bit about your rules? What makes the perfect office wife? Just outline one or two for us, you know, for all the aspiring office husbands. What should they look for?
I think it helps if one of you is actually married at home and one of you is not, because that way you get the best of both worlds. First of all, it removes all the possible tension around your office marriage becoming an office romance, which is an entirely different thing and not what we're talking about here. And secondly, you get to – the married person gets to live vicariously through the single person and hear about their dating life, and there's endless conversational fodder around that. And the single person gets to, I think, vicariously get a sense of stability from the married person and sort of realize that there's a whole world out there that's not about staying out till 4 a.m. and having these terrible short-term relationships. Anyway, so that's one rule. I also felt like it might be a little bit better if your work marriage is opposite sex. I have nothing against same-sex work marriages, but I think we tend to be a little bit more competitive with people.
You're
not
talking
about
gay people. You're just talking about, like, you know,
no. This is not about romance. This is not about sex or romance. This is about an office marriage. It's about an office domestic situation where I'm just saying I think it works better if it's a man and a woman. They could be gay. They could be straight. That's not about that. I just think the way you relate to each other in the office environment it might be a little bit better. However, I have seen same-sex work marriages work terrifically. I think all of us know Tim Noah and Jack Schaefer had a beautiful same-sex work marriage that went for many years in this late office, and we should all aspire to have a work marriage that lovely.
Should we explain a little bit more about what a work marriage consists of?
You do
so
what
you
together?
Share some things about your personal life. I have found personally that the sort of like making fun of silly things that happen in the office is a pretty crucial part of the work marriage.
I think you want to complain a little bit about the absurdities of your office, the bureaucracy. You want to probably bitch a little bit about your coworkers, you know, whether it be your superiors or your lackeys below you. The historians of the work marriage concept trace the origin back to this David Owen Atlantic piece in 1987. It's a really funny piece. And a couple of things he says sort of define a great work marriage is, as you walk past her desk on your way to a big meeting, she tells you that you have dried shaving cream behind your ear. Or she tells you things about her home husband that he wouldn't want you to know. Or she waits for you to finish up so you can go down the elevator together when you leave the office.
Oh, here's another one. Knows at least one thing about you, such as the fact that you can do a pretty good imitation of Liza Minnelli that your home wife doesn't know. I don't know about the Liza Minnelli thing, but I think that is important. It's this sense that, like, she has certain intimacies that the wife doesn't have.
Yeah, or complains to you without embarrassment about an uncomfortable undergarment. It's about a level of intimacy that you don't share with your other coworkers and sort of in some ways approximates the intimacy of a real marriage, but there's no sex here. It's not about that.
It has a floor, right? It's like your work wife would never ask you why you don't just put your dishes right into the dishwasher instead of leaving them in the sink, because she doesn't know you do this. She knows you only as you appear between 9 and 5, recently bathed, fully dressed, largely awake, and in control of your life. You know, that's an important part of it, is that she doesn't know, or in my case, he doesn't know, the like bad sides of you, right? It's not total intimacy the way you would have with an actual husband or wife. So that's an important part of it.
And it's no skin off her back if you don't, you know, wash your dishes. Like, she doesn't care. She doesn't have to live with that.
Right.
So, Hannah, you have an unusual situation. You work with your husband, and he also happens to be the boss, which is typically a figure about whom, you know, office spouses like to complain. So is David your office husband as well as your real husband?
He is so not my office husband. I hope he's not insulted by that. I mean, it's like I love to see him when I go downtown and it's very cute. And sometimes we have lunch together, but it really doesn't function in the same way because, you know, it's like immediately we'll start talking about the stuff that we have to talk about. You know, I mean, if it's like a really good day and we just manage to sort of flirt and go to lunch, then it approximates the relationship that I would have with an office husband. But no, it totally doesn't work the same way. It really, really doesn't. I had a wonderful office husband. I had a beautiful office marriage at my first job, which was at the New Republic, in fact. And, you know, I still think about it. It was wonderful. It was exactly as you described, Seth. I was you. Am I allowed to say who your office wife was?
The lovely and talented Jessica Gross, formerly of the Double X podcast.
Exactly. It was the lovely and talented Jess Gross. So I was Seth and my office husband was Jess Gross. He was newly married. And in fact, his wife had just had a baby. And that was part of the beauty of it. Like, we were just such good friends. We would like go biking sometimes, you know, we would talk about pieces. I mean, it was great. It was perfect. And I would talk about my, you know, disastrous love life at the time. And I really, really miss it because I work at home. And so, you know, when I go to the office, there's my real husband, which is not that satisfying. And then when I'm at home, I'm at home. So that's a bummer.
What do we think about alternative work arrangements, polygamous work marriages? You know, sometimes I think you might see another work marriage that was working really well. Maybe you think you could just horn in on it. My feeling is that doesn't work. I think you can't have a three-way like that. It's somebody's going to get jealous. But what I have seen work is a queen bee situation. This is at my job at Newsweek. There was one woman who had this sort of gaggle of young men orbiting around her at her beck and call. And it seemed to work for everyone. Everyone was happy. It was like a productive hive, I felt like. And I've heard that it can work the other way. I don't think I've witnessed it, but I've heard it can work the other way, sort of a harem situation where you have one man who is the sultan and has many women around him and he balances his attentions to them. You know, whatever floats your work marriage boat is fine with me. I think there are lots of ways to make it work, but I'm in favor of the institution of work marriage. I think it adds stability to the workplace. I think it's a good thing. We could talk about whether you should delay your work marriage and will it be stronger if you wait to work marry, or should you go just dive in right away. But in general, I think it's a positive thing in the workplace.
Now, Noreen, I believe you were making the argument for remote work marriage, which I would love if that were true. I do not see it to be true, but a lot of us work at home or have sort of drifty work situations, and so it's harder.
This is really the question of what happens to your work marriage when you move on to a new job. So I had a period of time where I was freelancing and I had a friend who was also freelancing. And so we were sort of freelance office spouses. Like, we would go to coffee shops and we would like bitch about like which editors hadn't emailed us back and like how little money we were making. And it was very much a work marriage. And we have both moved on to steadier employment since, but we continue g-chatting about editors who don't email us back. And there's a little bit of the old work marriage fire still there, right? I'm not sure if it's the same situation, but I do think that GChat has really enabled the work marriage to go to new heights.
But it has to start in person first. Mm-hmm. You can't have an entirely – I mean, I have GChat relationships with lots of women that are robust.
Right.
But there are people who I, you know already, who I have had, you know, physical proximity with for a long time before. You can't just, like, out of the blue choose somebody and start an IM flirtation with them.
at my last job, I had an office husband. And, you know, we still talk. I'm getting a drink with him next week, but it's just not the same. You know, I don't know about the emails from accounting and...
You don't have that shared, you know...
We have shared history, but, you know, we don't have the daily...
But you're drawing on that history that's in a vault and you're slowly depleting it.
Yeah.
You're not forming new bonds over how much you hate your boss
exactly.
or how much you hate the bureaucracy at your office.
Exactly.
So, Seth, you write at the end of the story about wooing a new office wife because the first one just happened organically. Is that possible? Can you, like, set your sights on an office wife and just say, like, this is going to be my girl? Like, is that how you do it? Because I was thinking I would imitate that if I ever went back to workplace. I would, like, choose somebody and, you know, actively seduce them to be my office husband.
I had thought when Jess left and Allison Benedict came in, also of the Double X podcast, that perhaps I could just, Allison, just slide into that work wife role. It didn't quite happen. Like, now she's on maternity leave. And so, you know, who knows? Who knows what will happen down the line? I still have some hopes.
Yeah. And she has three children. I mean, it's slightly different than, like, she's probably, like, all business when she's at the office, you know?
Yeah. She has less time to go goof around and go get coffee. She kind of wants to come into her work and go home, I think. I don't think it's a woo situation. Mm-hmm. I think it just has to develop. And so in that sense, it might be more like a friendship than like a marriage in terms of the way that it starts. I think it has to be organic. I don't think you can just set out to woo a work wife, and it's not like you can show up and give her a bouquet of roses at her cubicle pod. You know, it's just not like that.
Well, I have to say, and my last note here, that I really, really miss it. This is all really making me want to go back and work in an office. Unfortunately, it can't be Slate because the presence of an actual husband might be a barrier to finding a work husband. So maybe not only that David can't be it, but he might prevent anybody else from being it.
I'll be your remote work husband, Hannah. We can talk
about
it.
I would love to be your work wife, Seth. But A, I'm not, you know, I don't know. I'm not in New York. And B, I'm, you know, I don't know.
I think I'm not your work husband type.
Yeah,
I think
you're making letting you down easy.
You're making excuses. I think I'm just not your type. I think
no.
You're looking for something a little bit different. You want someone with more status in the workplace, don't you?
That's so not true. I think there might be decent candidates at the Atlantic is what I was getting at, since the Atlantic is in D.C. So maybe I'll go hunting there. Okay. All right. Let us move on to recommendations. Okay, Noreen, why don't you go first with our recommendations?
So I had never read any Renata Adler whatsoever, and two of her novels are being reissued. I've ordered one. I have not read it yet, but I have been reading sort of greedily everything I can on the internet about Renata Adler, who I'm newly fascinated with.
Katie Royfe wrote a story about her. I'll put that up.
Who did?
Katie Royfe did, in appreciation of Speedboat.
Oh, yeah, I read that. Yeah. As I said, everything on the internet. One of the things I read was her famous essay, sort of a takedown of Pauline Kael. I mean, it was very scandalous at the time. It was in the 80s. They were both New Yorker staff writers. And it's just sort of fun to go down that rabbit hole of old literary feuds. And it's a really well-done screed against someone. It's worth finding. It's in the New York Review of Books.
That sounds great. I love Speedboat. I'm a big fan of that 70s genre fiction of the ladies. So that's great. I have actually two recommendations this week. One is, I wrote about how Tide put a man in its laundry ad and how happy it made me to see that. And then Jess Gross, again, the story I mentioned, wrote about how cleaning is the final feminist frontier and men and housework. It just seems to be a topic bubbling up. So someone named Jim O'Brien runs a company called Man Metals, in which you order these metals and you give them to your man. And they say things like, I put the toilet paper roll on and I took the garbage out. And so I spread these around my house yesterday.
That's so condescending.
So condescending. It's amazing. And so I was totally obnoxious with these in my household this week. And I made David wear one, which I took a picture of and we'll post it on Facebook page. It's amazing he didn't kill me. And I made one of my sons wear one. He was very proud because he's too little to realize how patronizing they are. Anyway, so
I would make an I patronize my husband medal and make him wear it.
That's really good. You could do that. That could be the reverse. I'll put that on Facebook next week. I patronize my husband. So that's my first one. And my second one is a thriller called The Neverlist by Kothi Zan. She's a first-time novelist. She is also the wife of culture podcaster Stephen Metcalf. And it's an amazing book. It makes, you know, 50 Shades of Grey look like a joke. It's a really hardcore, involves a serial killer and a woman's hunt to kind of get retribution in a sense. It has incredibly interesting characters. It was so gripping that I didn't quite notice that I was flying through like a horrible snowstorm, which I was doing yesterday when I read the novel and really couldn't stop reading it. And its underlying theme is about how data is trumped by human passion and obsession, which is a theme that I really like. But anyway, I urge you all to read it. It's really great.
And it's not out quite yet. It's out July 16th, but you can pre-order now.
Yes, you can pre-order it now. So, Seth, you got anything for us?
I'm going to recommend a new portrayal that I'm noticing in television shows, which I think I've noticed as a late 30s single man, childless. I've noticed on TV shows these characters that I identify with that maybe I didn't used to notice. I'm thinking of Nashville. There's Deacon, who's this sort of recovering alcoholic, somewhat battered guy in his late 30s or early 40s who has this flame that maybe is going to rekindle with Connie Britton. And then on the Mindy Project, you have Dr. Danny, who's this guy in his late 30s and has come out of a divorce and now he's dating again. And then on The League, you have Pete, played by Mark Duplass, who's the sort of the one single guy, or actually there's another single guy, but he's the one normal single guy who anyone could relate to on the show. And I like these portrayals, and I find myself identifying with them. And I'm wondering now, I kind of want to go back to older TV shows and see how this sort of character was portrayed then and whether the portrayal has changed over time.
What about it do you like? Curiosity.
It speaks to me. I identify in a way that maybe I didn't used to when I wasn't in this kind of situation. And this is not a recommendation, is it?
This is a Slate piece. This is both a recommendation and a Slate piece.
Yeah,
I'm recommending the Slate piece is going to come out of this, searching conversation I'm having with you right now.
I think you're recommending like men in their late 30s.
I really don't want to recommend. That's a poor recommendation. Do not follow that recommendation.
Why don't you just recommend yourself, Seth? I think that's a good
I just would like to recommend myself.
Okay.
Let's delete that entire.
It's good. It's good. It's like you're recommending good-looking grizzled men in their 30s.
We can all get behind that one.
Like to imagine I'm one of those good-looking grizzled men on the show.
And
I think
you
is what
are,
I'm saying,
Seth.
And I enjoy imagining myself as those guys.
You are. We'll second that. Okay. On that note, I would like to thank Abdullah Rufus for engineering this podcast, Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. For Noreen and Seth, I'm Hannah Rosen. Thank you for joining us. And please, as always, come on our Facebook page and tell us what you'd like us to talk about in a couple of weeks. Talk to you then.
Don't forget it, don't forget it. Respect that. Bow down, witches. I took some time to live my life, but don't think I'm just his little wife. Don't get it twisted, get it twisted. Just my shit. Bow down, bitches. Bow down, bitches. Bow down, bitches. Bow down, bitches. Bow down, bitches.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.